Picture this scenario, right? You've just moved to London, or I don't know, maybe you're up in Scotland for university.
Right.
And you've played ice hockey your entire life in North America. You know the game inside and out.
You think you know it anyway.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You step onto the ice for your very first league game in the UK, and you're feeling, you know, incredibly confident.
Yeah.
You take one lap in warm-ups, maybe snap a quick wrist shot against the glass, and suddenly, out of nowhere, the referee skates over, points directly at you, and then points straight to the dressing room.
It's brutal.
Your night is completely over before the puck is even dropped for the opening faceoff. And why? Because your jersey wasn't covering your neck and you weren't wearing a specific piece of fabric.
Yeah, it is it's a seriously rude awakening. And honestly, it happens far more often than you might think.
I bet.
That scenario is exactly why we are here today. Because that precision instrument you thought you understood, the rule book you've internalized from, you know, decades of watching the NHL or playing in Canada and the US,
right,
it operates on a completely different frequency the exact moment you step onto British ice.
It is the absolute definition of a regulatory minefield. So, welcome everyone to a very special masterclass deep dive.
A very necessary one.
Absolutely. Our mission today is to completely rewire how you understand the rules of ice hockey if you are stepping onto the ice in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, and we are talking directly to you.
Yes, you listening. Whether you are an adult league player lacing them up in Sheffield, a university student playing varsity down in Cardiff, or just someone who learned the game watching North American broadcasts.
Right, and you just want to know how the international game functions locally.
Exactly. We are going to dismantle the assumptions you've built up, replace them with a bulletproof, comprehensive mental model of British hockey for the 2026-27 season.
Because building that mental model is not just about avoiding embarrassment, you know?
No, the stakes are way higher.
Way higher. If you assume the game you watch on television is the exact same game you are about to play in the UK, you are going to get ejected.
Or worse.
Right, or worse. You are going to put yourself or a teammate in serious physical danger. Or, frankly, you are going to cost your team a vital game because you just didn't understand the mechanisms of a penalty here.
So we are going to build this understanding progressively. We will start with the foundational framework of whose game we are actually playing, and then we will move layer by layer into the geometry of the rink, the zero-tolerance safety culture, and finally, the exact penalties that serve as well, basically hidden trapdoors to end your night.
I love that approach because we really can't talk about how to play the game until we understand who is actually writing the rules.
Right. So let's establish that baseline. If I'm stepping onto the ice tonight, whose rule book am I physically or I guess mentally carrying my hockey bag?
So you are carrying a layered system.
Layered.
Yeah. The core foundation of UK hockey runs on the International Ice Hockey Federation rule book. The IIHF.
Got it.
That is your international baseline. The geometry of the rink, the definitions of fouls, it all starts right there. But, and this is a big but, you cannot stop there.
Why not?
Because over top of that IIHF foundation, there is a very specific, highly localized layer of domestic amendments. They're called the in-house rules.
Okay, so if I'm preparing for my season and say I'm watching a YouTube breakdown of a specific penalty situation and the creator references an NHL rule.
You must completely ignore it.
Do you ignore it entirely?
Entirely. The NHL rulebook is a different species.
What if I'm reading a USA hockey manual or like a Hockey Canada coaching guide?
You ignore those as well.
Really? Even Hockey Canada?
Yep. They are completely irrelevant to your situation in the UK. If the source material you are studying flags an IIHF rule, you pay attention. That is your game.
Right.
But, and this is the vital mechanism to understand, if the UK in-house rules amend that specific IIHF rule, then the UK version overrides the international one.
Oh, okay.
The in-house document is your ultimate final reality.
That immediately frames how careful we have to be. Because to truly understand these in-house rules, we need to understand the 2026 administrative landscape.
Yeah, because there has been a massive shift recently.
Right. If I've been away from the UK game for a few years, I might be, you know, thoroughly confused by the alphabet soup of acronyms governing the sport right now.
It can absolutely look like an alphabet soup to an outsider. So let's paint a clear picture of what the administrative landscape looks like right now.
Let's do it.
In June of 2026, there was a major historic administrative merger, England Ice Hockey, which you will still hear veteran players refer to as the EIAA.
Right, old habits.
Exactly. They merged with Scottish Ice Hockey, the SIH, into Ice Hockey UK. So IHUK is now the unified overarching governing body for the four home nations, England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland.
So IHUK is the big umbrella now.
Yeah.
What about university hockey? Because university hockey in the UK has a very distinct, almost raucous culture of its own.
It definitely does. Yes. Sitting right alongside IOCHA is the BUIAA, the British Universities Ice Hockey Association. They govern the university structure.
Okay.
But the crucial unifying factor is that all of these bodies, IHUK, the specific leagues beneath them, like the NIHL or the Scottish National League and the BUIAA, they all adopt these singular in-house rules.
So that document is the connective tissue for everyone.
Exactly.
Which makes that document incredibly important. It is the absolute law of the land.
It is.
But as we dug into our sources for this deep dive, we found something that is genuinely mind-bending. A massive contradiction sitting right at the heart of this unified governing document.
Oh, yeah. It is a literal trap for anyone trying to prepare for the season.
Let's unpack this rulebook trap.
It is a bureaucratic trap that has massive real-world consequences on the ice. If you open the current UK in-house rules document, the introduction explicitly and proudly points to the 2025-26 IIHF rulebook.
Okay, 2025-26.
Specifically, it cites version 1.1, published July 2025. It explicitly calls that specific version the latest rulebook.
Which seems perfectly straightforward, right? You read the intro, it tells you what book to buy or download, and you're good to go.
It would be straightforward, except for what happens when you look at the cover of that exact same in-house rules document.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. The cover explicitly states that it relies on the, quote, current IIHF rulebook. Now, in the global world of the IIHF, the actual true current rulebook for this season is the 2026-27 edition.
Okay.
And here is where the trap snaps shut. Newer 2026-27 edition actually carries a lower version number.
Wait, what?
Yeah. It is version 1.0, published in June 2026.
I want to make sure I'm visualizing this correctly. The older 2025 book is labeled version 1.1, and the newer 2026 book is labeled version 1.0.
Exactly. The IIHF reset their version numbering for the new season.
Wow.
So the introduction of the UK document names the older book, citing its 1.1 version number, and calls it the latest. But the cover of the same UK document points to the current book, which in reality is the 1.0 version from 2026.
That's a direct, inescapable contradiction written right into the governing document itself.
It is.
This is wild. This is exactly like trying to play, I don't know, a highly competitive multiplayer video game. But the referee, or the server, is running version 1.0 of the software, and you, the player, downloaded version 1.1 because the manual told you to.
That's the perfect analogy.
How do you even know what a penalty is if you don't know which patch notes the game is actually using? Like, why does a single year matter so much? Is it just a few minor wording tweaks?
If it were just wording tweaks, we wouldn't be dedicating this time to it. What makes this so critical is that the IIHF didn't just adjust grammar between those two editions.
What did they do?
The 2026-27 book completely and fundamentally renumbers major game-altering sections of the rules.
Give me a concrete example. What happens if, say, a player gets into an altercation?
Let's look at Rule 46. It's the cornerstone rule governing fighting and altercations. It was entirely reorganized in the new book.
Good.
If you, as a player or a coach, are studying the 2025 book because the introduction told you to, you will read that the penalty for being the third player into a fight is Rule 46.7.
Right. Third man in.
But if the referee on the ice is holding the 2026 book, Rule 46.7 no longer means third player in.
What does it mean?
Under the new book, Rule 46.7 is the penalty for fighting off the playing surface.
Wow. That is a massive distinction. Fighting off the playing surface, like in the tunnel or the dressing room hallway, carries wildly different disciplinary weight than just jumping into a scrum on the ice.
Exactly. If a coach is arguing with a referee, citing a specific rule number, they could be talking about two entirely different realities.
It changes the entire dialogue on the ice.
It does. But it gets even deeper than just the text of the rules.
Right.
The 2026-27 book also completely merges the critical penalty reference tables at the back of the book.
The reverse tables are essentially the quick reference cheat sheets for officials, right?
Right. In the older 2025 book, there is a specific table, Table 6, which is a dedicated list of all the infractions that carry an automatic game misconduct.
So if you commit a foul on Table 6, you're out.
You are ejected. Every experienced coach knows about Table 6. But in the 2026 book, Table 6 completely disappears.
Disappears entirely.
It doesn't exist. It gets merged into a giant, sweeping new Table 5.
Oh, boy. So picture this scene. A player takes a heavy hit. The coach is furious, screaming over the glass at the referee, "That's a major. Check table six. Check table six."
And the referee, if they are carrying the 2026 book, will look at that coach and completely accurately reply, "Coach, table six doesn't exist."
That creates instant friction, confusion, a breakdown of trust between the benches and the officials.
Of absolute chaos.
So as a player, I am stepping onto the ice tonight. I have my gear bag packed. I cannot pause the game, skate over the referee's crease, and ask them for a bibliographic citation of the rulebook before I make a hit.
No, you can't.
So what is the actual practical strategy here? How do I navigate a contradiction that the governing body hasn't even fixed?
You have to adopt a two-pronged, highly defensive strategy.
Okay, prong one.
First, in your mental preparation, you must plan around the absolute strictest reading of both editions.
Makes sense.
If the 2025 book says a specific penalty might just be a 2-minute minor, but the 2026 book says it is a 5-minute major plus an automatic ejection, you must play the game as if it's an ejection. You assume the worst case scenario.
Protect yourself by assuming the tightest parameters. And the second prong.
The second is administrative proactivity. You, or, you know, your team manager, must explicitly ask your league administrators before the season begins which physical version of the rulebook their specific officials have been instructed to carry and enforce.
Get it in writing.
Yes. You cannot assume that because the NIHL uses the 2026 book, a local recreational league in Scotland uses the same one. You must get it in writing from your league.
So if I'm weaving this into my mental model, the overarching takeaway from this first layer isn't just about knowing the rules. It's about knowing which rules exist in the specific reality of the rink you are standing in. The UK in-house rules overlay the IIHF rules. And because of this massive documentation typo, you absolutely must verify the exact year of the IIHF baseline your league is using. You simply cannot afford to assume anything.
That is the exact mindset of a veteran player. You manage the bureaucracy before it manages you on the ice.
Brilliant. Okay, so now that we understand the shifting sands of the rule books, let's move from the paperwork to the physical, visceral reality on the ice. Let's talk about the gear you put on your body.
This is a big one.
And for anyone listening who grew up playing in North America, this is the absolute aha moment. This is the sharpest, most jarring cultural and regulatory difference you will encounter. We're talking about the UK A zero tolerance safety model. And it begins with a neck guard.
Yes, formerly known in the rulebook as the neck laceration protector. And you are right to call it a cultural difference because the approach to preventative safety here is fundamentally different than what many imports are used to.
In the NHL, we see guys flying down the wing with their jerseys unbuttoned, chest hair blowing in the wind, helmets tilted back. It's almost a style choice.
Yeah, the classic look.
Right. And in USA hockey, if you were playing in an adult recreational league, neck guards are entirely optional. It's a personal risk assessment. In Hockey Canada, adults are generally exempt as well.
Yeah.
So a North American adult moves to the UK, unpacks their bag and thinks, "I'm a grown adult. I played for 20 years. I know the risks. I don't need a neck guard."
And if they try to actualize that thought, they will not be playing hockey that night. It is that simple.
Wow.
In the UK, under the in-house rules, a neck laceration protector is absolutely mandatory for everyone. Every single player on the ice.
No exceptions.
None. That includes fully grown adults in the senior leagues, university students in BUI Hay, and every junior player. The rule states it must cover as much of the neck as possible. And the enforcement mechanism isn't just strict. It is instantaneous and punitive.
Let's walk through the mechanics of that strictness. Let's say I skate out for the pregame warm-ups. I just forgot it in my bag. I'm taking laps. What happens next?
The defining characteristic of this rule is that there are absolutely zero warnings. None whatsoever.
Wait, not even a referee skating by and tapping his own neck saying, "Hey, buddy, go grab your guard before the puck drops."
No. That might happen in a casual pickup game, sure. But in a sanctioned league game, the moment you are caught without a neck guard on the ice, it is an immediate 10-minute misconduct penalty.
10 minutes before the game even starts.
Think about the impact of that. You are sitting in the penalty box for a sixth of the entire game, instantly. If you are a top-line center, your coach now has to scramble the lines. You are cold, your team is disrupted, and you haven't even played a shift.
Okay, so let's say I serve my 10 minutes of shame. I borrow a teammate's backup neck guard, I put it on, and I get back into the game. Midway through the second period, I'm in a heavy battle in the corner. Someone's stick gets up, catches the Velcro, and my neck guard gets ripped off or falls down.
It happens.
Or maybe I just didn't secure it properly, and the referee notices it hanging loose. The first offense was a 10-minute misconduct. What is the escalation for a second offense?
A second offense by the exact same player escalates automatically to a game misconduct. You are instantly ejected.
Seriously.
You go straight to the dressing room, you take off your gear, and your night is over.
Over a piece of fabric falling off.
Over safety. The UK governing bodies view a laceration risk as an unacceptable, preventable catastrophe. And to your point about it falling off during play, this is an incredibly critical mechanism to understand. If your neck guard comes loose or falls off while the puck is live and in play, you must immediately abandon the play and leave the ice.
Leave the ice completely.
You go straight to the bench.
Wait, what if it falls right at my feet in the neutral zone? Nobody is around me. Can I just quickly bend down, scoop it up, Velcro it back on, and jump back into the rush?
Absolutely not. The rule is explicitly clear. You may not retrieve it.
I can't even pick it up.
If you bend down to pick it up, you are violating the rule and you will be penalized. You must abandon the neck guard on the ice as if it doesn't belong to you, skate directly to the bench to get a replacement, and have a teammate, a coach, or an official retrieve the dropped guard only when the referee stops the play.
I want to make sure the listener really absorbs the severity of this. This is like a seatbelt law in an incredibly strict zero-tolerance jurisdiction.
Yes.
The police officer pulling you over doesn't care if the seatbelt just unbuckled by accident a second ago or if you were just adjusting your heavy winter jacket.
Mm.
If they see it off, you are getting the ticket. You don't pause to try and fix it while you are actively driving and moving traffic. The law demands you pull the car over immediately. In hockey terms, you pull yourself over. You get off the ice.
That seatbelt analogy is the exact mental model every player needs to adopt. And it is crucial to understand that this zero tolerance policy extends far beyond just league games. In England and Wales specifically, England ice hockey rules mandate that neck guards must be worn for all on-ice activities.
Meaning practices.
Practices. Casual stick and puck sessions. Tryouts. Everything. Furthermore, for the 2026-27 season, they introduced a new enforcement layer. Coaches are now legally required to visually verify that every single player has a neck guard securely fastened before the warm-up even begins.
So the coach is essentially deputized. They are forced to act as the first line of enforcement before the referee even steps onto the ice.
Precisely. The liability is pushed down to the team level. Now, if we connect this intense focus on neck safety to the broader picture of head trauma, we have to talk about helmets and facial protection. Because just like the rule books, the UK has very specific layered mandates for helmets that do not always match what North American players expect.
Right. Let's unpack the helmet mandates, because my understanding is that it differs significantly depending on your age, your gender, and surprisingly, your geography.
Yeah.
Let's start with women's hockey.
In women's hockey in the UK, the rules regarding facial protection are tied strictly to age. Full face protection, meaning you are wearing a full metal cage or a full clear visor, is mandatory until the season following your 18th birthday.
After they turn 18, then what?
Once you officially pass that 18th birthday threshold into the next season, the in-house rules permit you to drop down to a half visor. But beneath that age, there are no exceptions. It is full face.
What about the university level? The BUIA? Or the Scottish Recreational Hockey Leagues. A lot of adults play in those.
For both BUIA and Scottish Rec, regardless of how old you are, a half visor is the absolute minimum standard. You cannot play with just a helmet and no visor, ever.
And for the juniors, the youth leagues. This is where I saw something fascinating in the source material about geography.
Geography absolutely matters here. If you are playing junior hockey physically located in England or Wales, face cages, the metal wire masks are strictly mandatory.
So you can't wear the clear bubble.
Right. You cannot wear the full clear plastic bubble visors. But if your team travels across the border to play a tournament in Scotland, or if you are in a jurisdiction operating strictly under the baseline IIHF rules, the rule permits either a cage or a full face clear visor.
Unbelievable.
So again, you have to know exactly whose jurisdiction you are physically standing in when you pack your helmet bag.
Let's talk about the physical fit of the helmet itself. I remember growing up playing in North America, and there was a whole culture around helmet style.
Oh, yeah. The loose chin strap.
Exactly. Guys would have their chin straps hanging down to their collarbones, incredibly loose, just so they could easily pop their mouth guards in and out without unbuckling.
If you try to bring that style to the UK, you are going to spend your night in the penalty box.
Really? How strict is it?
The rule regarding chin straps is mathematically specific. The maximum allowable gap between your chin and the chin strap is 2.5 centimeter.
2.5 centimeters. So we're talking about roughly the width of one single finger.
Exactly one finger width. The officials will check this. If your strap is visibly looser than that, the mechanism of enforcement is tiered.
How does that tier work?
The first offense gets you sent directly to the bench to fix it. You lose your shift. If you come back onto the ice and it is still loose, or if it happens again later in the game, it escalates to a 10-minute misconduct.
Another 10-minute misconduct. Wow.
And just like the neck guard rule, if your helmet detaches during live play, say you take a hit and it pops off, you do not finish your shift. You do not stop in the corner, pick it up, and strap it back on. You must leave the ice instantly. Continuing to play bareheaded, even for a second to make a pass, is a misconduct penalty.
What about customizing my gear? Like, I'm picturing a guy who just moved over. He has a Bauer helmet he loves that fits his head perfectly.
Yeah.
But he strongly prefers the sight lines of a CCM cage. In North America, he would just grab some screws in the locker room and attach the CCM cage to the Bauer helmet. I'm guessing a DIY hardware job like that is going to set off some alarms here.
It will set off massive alarms. You have to be incredibly careful with customization.
Why?
The in-house rules explicitly state that helmet and face mask combinations must match manufacturer sizing and intent. If you mix mismatched cages and helmets, or if you alter the mounting points, the referee is instructed to classify it as dangerous equipment.
Dangerous equipment. So what happens?
You will be immediately removed from the ice until you return with a factory standard matching helmet and cage combination. The governing bodies simply will not accept the liability of untested equipment configurations.
That is wild, but it makes sense from a liability standpoint. Okay, so clearly the UK takes preventative safety equipment incredibly seriously. It is a true zero-tolerance environment, which naturally leads me to assume that if they care this much about preventing injuries, the medical care waiting at the rink must be equally top tier.
Well,
if I'm playing a physical league game in England or Wales, and the rules are this tight, I'm assuming there is a doctor on standby in the building, maybe an ambulance idling out back.
This raises a profoundly important point, and it is time to dispel a massive, potentially dangerous assumption.
Okay.
The preventative rules on the ice are undeniably strict, yes. But the actual medical realities waiting at the rink might deeply shock a North American player who is used to collegiate or high-level junior medical support.
What do you mean?
If you're playing a sanctioned game in England or Wales, the governing rule only mandates four specific things regarding medical cover.
Just four things. For a full contact sport, what are they?
Let's list them. One, a first aider must be present. And I want to be precise with the language here. The rule attaches absolutely no specific medical qualification to that title.
So it could just be a volunteer who took a weekend course?
It does not require a paramedic or a nurse.
No.
Two, a first aid kit that has been visually checked before the game. Three, a risk assessment and emergency action plan that is documented and shared with the visiting team. And four, a functioning telephone to call emergency services. That is the legal minimum.
No ambulance requirement.
An ambulance is explicitly not required to be on standby. Having a doctor or a physiotherapist present is only recommended by the governing body. It is never mandatory.
That is shocking.
So you could very easily be playing a highly physical, intense, high-stakes hockey game with nothing more than a designated volunteer first aider, a checked box of bandages, and a landline phone.
Wow.
And to make it even more concerning, outside of England and Wales, for example, in Scotland, there isn't even a published document that explicitly guarantees those four basic things.
So the safety net is incredibly thin. This means teammates have to know how to react.
Absolutely.
Let's walk through a critical emergency action scenario, because this is vital. I'm on the ice. A teammate of mine goes hard head first into the boards. They are down on the ice, not moving well. I suspect a severe neck or spinal injury. As an expert, what is the exact step-by-step process I must follow in the UK rink, knowing that an ambulance isn't parked outside?
The first thing you must do is mentally reference the UK concussion guidelines for grassroots sport and the CRT6, the concussion recognition tool. You must instantly look for red flags.
Like what?
Is there severe neck pain? Is their consciousness deteriorating? Are they becoming increasingly confused or agitated? If you see any of those red flags, you bypass the rink's first aider and you, or a coach, must call 999 immediately.
999, not 111.
Exactly. 111 is the NHS non-emergency number designed for assessment within 24 hours. For a suspected neck injury, spinal trauma, or severe concussion red flags, it is a catastrophic emergency. You dial 999 for an immediate ambulance dispatch.
And what do I do with my teammate while we wait? Human instinct says I should take their helmet off so they can breathe easier, or maybe roll them onto their back to check their eyes.
You must fight every ounce of that instinct. Absolutely do not remove the helmet.
Leave it on.
Leave it on. The CRT6 international guidance is explicit and non-negotiable. Do not remove the helmet or any other equipment. Taking off a tight hockey helmet forces the neck to flex and extend, which could turn a manageable spinal fracture into a permanent paralysis.
So the helmet stays on. Do I move them?
No, you do not move the player under any circumstances. The UK medical guidance explicitly states that a player with a suspected neck or spinal injury should only be moved by healthcare professionals with appropriate specialized training, meaning paramedics with backboards and cervical collars.
Right.
You, as a teammate, are not that person. You leave the helmet on, you keep them as still and calm as possible, you clear the area of other players, and you wait for 999 to arrive.
So, if I'm synthesizing this entire zero tolerance safety section, the core takeaway is that North American exemptions are completely dead on arrival in the UK.
Yeah.
You cannot talk your way out of a penalty by citing your age or your experience level.
No, you can't.
The safety violation isn't a gentle tap on the wrist. It is an instant, heavy penalty that disrupts your team. And crucially, because the medical infrastructure at the rink is so minimal, you are entirely reliant on external emergency services. You have to know how to trigger the 9999 system, and you must protect an injured player by never removing their helmet.
That is an excellent summary. You manage your gear perfectly, so you stay on the ice, and you manage emergencies perfectly because the safety net is thin.
Incredible. Okay, so we are wearing our neck guards. Our chin straps are tightened to exactly one finger width, and we know our emergency protocols. Let's talk about the physical space we're actually playing in, because the ice itself dictates how the game is played. Let's move into the geometry and mechanics of the UK rink.
The geometry of the rink dictates the physics of the game. Rink size changes everything about how hockey is processed by a player's brain.
Okay, let's establish the baseline size.
The IIHF standard dimensions dictate a sheet of ice that is 60 meters long and between 26 and 30 meters wide. That is a massive Olympic-sized sheet of ice. It feels expansive. You have time to glide, time to look up, time to make a decision.
But from the source material, I know that if you step into a local UK rink, that expansive feeling might vanish instantly. The UK in-house rules authorize something fundamentally different from the IIHF standard, don't they?
They do. The in-house rules explicitly authorize rinks that are smaller than 56 meters by 26 meters for all levels of play.
That's quite a bit smaller.
Yeah, and they even legally grandfathered in specific, famously small rinks like Sutton in England and Coatbridge in Scotland. These rinks are permitted to host under 16 play despite being incredibly small compared to international standards.
Here is where it gets really interesting to me. It's not just a trivia fact about square footage. How does that smaller geometry actively change the decisions a player has to make?
What's fascinating is the physics of it. When you shrink a rink down from 60 meters to, say, 52 or 54 meters, the angles of the game stay exactly the same. The physics of a bank pass off the boards, or the angle a goaltender takes to cut off a shooter, those remain constant. But the distances shrink dramatically.
Which means time and space vanish. The currency of hockey is time and space, and suddenly your wallet is empty.
Exactly. Let's visualize a standard breakout. Your defenseman gets the puck behind the net. On a 60-meter Olympic rink, the opposing forechecker has to skate a long distance to apply pressure. The defenseman has an extra half second to scan the ice, read the wingers, and make a tape-to-tape pass.
Right.
On a smaller UK rink, that forechecker is on top of the defenseman a half second faster. The neutral zone trap closes incredibly quickly. Defensemen have to pivot backwards sooner because the red line is closer to the blue line. Everything is compressed.
So the mental model here is that you cannot just look at the IIHF rulebook to understand your playing surface. You have to physically scan the specific UK rink you are standing in during warm-ups and consciously recalibrate your internal clock for a smaller sheet of ice.
Exactly. You must play the rink, not the rulebook.
Let's talk about the lines painted on that ice, specifically around the goaltender. I want to talk about the phantom trapezoid.
Ah, the trapezoid.
In the NHL and in international play, there is a trapezoid painted behind the net. The goalie can only play the puck safely if they're inside that trapezoid. If they wander into the deep corners to play the puck, it's an automatic penalty. Is there a trapezoid in the UK?
This is a classic, perfect example of how rule layering creates confusion. The baseline IIHF rulebook does indeed have a trapezoid rule. It's formally called the goalkeeper's restricted area. So technically under the IIHF foundation, yes, the trapezoid exists and playing the puck in the corners is illegal.
Okay.
But England Ice Hockey explicitly suspended the enforcement of the trapezoid rule for domestic play.
They suspended an international rule. Why? Did they disagree with the philosophy of it?
No, it was purely logistical. They suspended it to give the local multi-use public rinks the physical time and budget required to actually drain the ice and paint the new lines. You can't penalize a goalie for crossing a line that literally isn't painted on the ice.
That is hilarious. Pragmatism overrides the rule book. But wait, we established earlier that England ice hockey only governs England and Wales. What about the rest of the UK?
Precisely. That suspension is local. It does not apply to Scotland. It does not apply to Northern Ireland.
Where?
And it does not apply to university hockey governed by the BUIHA.
So it's a patchwork.
Yes. For those jurisdictions, the IOHF trapezoid rule is technically still live and enforceable, assuming the rink has the lines.
Okay, so let's say I am a goalie playing a league game in Sheffield, England. The trapezoid rule is suspended. That means I have total freedom, right? I can wander into the corner, retrieve a dump in, and play the puck safely without fear of a penalty.
Yes. Regarding the specific trapezoid restriction, you can play the puck. But here is the massive trapdoor that goalies fall through.
What's the trapdoor?
Even though the trapezoid restriction is suspended, there is an entirely separate rule regarding goaltenders that is not suspended. A goalie can still receive a delay of game penalty if they deliberately cause a stoppage of play outside of their crease.
Ooh. I see how this plays out. The goalie skates into the deep corner because they know the trapezoid rule is suspended. They go to play the puck, but an aggressive opposing forechecker is bearing down on them. The goalie gets scared, realizes they can't make a clean pass, and simply falls on the puck to freeze it against the boards.
And that is an instant 2-minute minor penalty for delay of game. You are completely allowed to play the puck in the corner, but you absolutely cannot deliberately freeze it there to force a whistle. Goalies often conflate the suspension of the trapezoid with a suspension of all rules in the corner. It is a vital distinction.
That is exactly the kind of nuanced trap we are trying to expose. Okay, let's move out of the crease and talk about the face-off dots, the puck drops. What are the specific mechanics for face-offs in the UK for this upcoming 2026-27 season?
There are two major structural changes to how face-offs are conducted. First, the penalty for a violation has changed. Any violation by anyone on your team, with the single exception of an icing call, results in your center being replaced in the dot.
Wait, so if my winger jumps into the circle too early, trying to anticipate the drop, the winger doesn't get punished, my center gets kicked out.
Correct. Your center is waved out and another player on the ice has to take the draw.
Wow.
It puts an immense amount of pressure on the wingers and defensemen to stay disciplined and still because their mistake punishes their centermen.
And the second major change.
It is regarding the stick down order. The IIHF baseline book dictates a very specific, rigid order for who has to put their stick blade on the ice first. Usually it's the defending player in their own zone or the visiting player at center ice.
Because putting your stick down first is a disadvantage, right?
Exactly. The player putting their stick down first is at a slight biomechanical disadvantage, but the UK in-house rules threw that specific order completely out the window. The new UK rule states that either center can put their stick down first.
That turns the face-off into a psychological game of chicken. Who blinks first?
It absolutely does. It changes the entire rhythm and timing of the face-off. Centermen will hover their sticks, waiting for the opponent to commit. The referee just waits until someone finally touches the ice and then drops the puck.
Let's fast forward in our hypothetical game. The game has been a grind. It's tied at the end of the third period. The final buzzer goes. The crowd is buzzing. We are going to overtime.
Oh.
3-on-3 chaos.
Not necessarily. In fact, probably not.
Wait, really? We don't just automatically play overtime to resolve a tie?
No. The concept of overtime is not universal in the UK league structures. Many games simply end in a tie, and both teams take a point and go home.
Just a tie.
Yeah. Overtime only exists in very specific pockets. The National Ice Hockey League, the NHL-specific Scottish National League fixtures where the tournament rules explicitly ask for it, and designated BYHA varsity OT games. If you aren't playing in one of those specific designated buckets, you shake hands at the end of 60 minutes.
Let's say we are in the NHL and we do go to a shootout. Internationally, a shootout is 5 shooters per team. Is it the same here?
No. The UK shootout features only three shooters per team. And crucially, unlike the IIHF rules, where you have to cycle through your entire roster before someone can shoot twice, the UK rules state those three shooters don't have to be different people. The exact same player can shoot multiple times in the initial rounds.
Oh, wow. So if you have one absolute sniper on your team with a nasty backhand shelf move, the coach can just send him out for round one, round two, and round three.
Exactly. It completely changes shootout strategy.
What about the highest stakes possible? The playoff final weekend, the biggest game of the year.
The playoff final weekend has two different sets of rules depending on which day it is. The semifinals on Saturday can go to a shootout to resolve a tie, but the grand final on Sunday has no shootout at all.
So what happens?
If the final is tied, you play successive full 20-minute 5-on-5 sudden death periods until someone scores a golden goal. It is a grueling test of endurance. It could go on until midnight.
So if I'm tying this all together into my mental model, this section on geometry and mechanics perfectly reinforces our earlier rulebook discussion. Just like you need to verify the exact version of the rulebook, you must verify the local physical exceptions.
Exactly right.
The UK exceptions, like a physically smaller rink size or the suspension of the trapezoid in specific countries, completely override the international baseline. You must play the physical rink you are standing on, and you must know the specific format of the league you are playing in, rather than relying on a generic understanding of hockey rules.
That is the perfect synthesis. You are adapting to the specific local reality of the game.
Okay, let's take a deep breath, because we are moving into the most dangerous, highly punitive part of the rulebook. We are entering the ejection trapdoors.
The trapdoors.
These are the penalties that don't just put you in the box. They end your night completely. And this is exactly where North American players, who play a very physical style, get themselves into massive game-losing trouble.
They really do. The philosophical approach to penalizing physical fouls in the UK is fundamentally different. We need to look closely at IIHF Rule 20.4 and reference Table 6. This is the first major ejection rule.
Let's hear it.
In the UK, if you are an adult player and you take your very first major penalty of the game for specific high-risk infractions, things like cross-checking, slashing, checking from behind, or an illegal check to the head, that major penalty carries an automatic game misconduct.
Let me stop you there, because I can predict exactly what a North American listener is thinking.
Oh.
Wait a minute. In the NHL, you usually need to cause an injury to get ejected for a lot of those fouls. If I cross-check a guy heavily into the boards, but he pops right back up and skates away, it's just a 2-minute minor, or maybe a 5-minute major if it looked bad, but I definitely stay in the game.
And acting on that assumption is exactly what will get you ejected in your first UK game. Under the IIHF and UK rules, no injury is required to trigger the ejection.
No injury required.
None. The referee does not care if the player bounced right back up. They don't care if there is no blood. The UK philosophy punishes the action, not the result. Recklessness alone triggers the ejection. Endangerment triggers the ejection. If the act itself was dangerous, you are gone.
So one reckless cross-check, nobody is hurt, no blood on the ice, and my game is instantly over. I am taking my skates off.
Yes, and the net gets even tighter.
How so?
Let's say you avoid major penalties, but you take two major penalties for lesser infractions, or two misconduct penalties over the course of the game. A second major or a second misconduct in a single game also results in an automatic ejection.
Wait, remember the neck guard rule from earlier?
Exactly. Let's walk through how these trapdoors combine. The penalty for a missing neck guard was a 10-minute misconduct. So if you step on the ice for warm-ups without your neck guard, you receive a misconduct before the puck drops. Fast forward to the third period. You get frustrated with a referee's call, and you slam your stick against the glass in protest. That is an unsportsmanlike conduct penalty, which carries another misconduct. That is your second misconduct of the game. You are automatically ejected. Your missing net guard 2 hours ago just contributed to you being thrown out of the third period.
It is a compounding cascade of consequences. Now, in North America, the worst possible penalty tier is a match penalty. It's usually reserved for a deliberate intent to injure, like kicking a player with a skate blade, and it carries an automatic suspension. Are there match penalties in the UK rulebook?
What's fascinating about the disciplinary structure is that the IIHF rulebook has completely eliminated the match penalty tier. It doesn't exist.
Really?
The major penalty plus the automatic game misconduct is the absolute ceiling of what a referee can hand out during the live game.
Why would they eliminate the highest penalty tier? Does that mean players can just run wild without fear of suspension?
Not at all. It actually shifts the power. By making the major plus game misconduct the ceiling, it de-escalates the immediate on-ice argument. The referee isn't debating intent to injure in real time. They just eject the player. Any further suspension or supplementary discipline is applied post-game by a league disciplinary committee.
I see.
And that committee's power to suspend you is essentially uncapped. They review the footage on a Tuesday and hand down the real punishment.
Let's talk about the specific labels officials put on these fouls, because there's a new directive for the 2026-27 season regarding specificity. Officials are now instructed to call the foul exactly what it physically is.
Right.
For example, instead of calling a generic, scary-sounding penalty like checking to the head, they are instructed to call it cross-checking if you actually hit a guy in the head with the shaft of your stick.
That is correct. The governing bodies want precise data on what types of fouls are actually occurring, so they demand specificity in the labeling on the official score sheet.
Let me push back on this from a player's perspective. If the referee downgrades the name of my penalty, if he just calls it cross-checking instead of the terrifying checking to the head, does that relabeling save me from being ejected? It sounds less severe.
No, it does not save you. This is a crucial, common misunderstanding among players. Both of those labels, cross-checking and checking to the head, sit squarely on reference table 6.
Or, I guess, table 5 in the new book.
Exactly, the new table 5. They are both automatic ejections on the first major. The underlying tier of the penalty doesn't change, just the taxonomic label applied to it. A rose by any other name is still an ejection. You are still taking off your skates.
Let's pivot to something that drives fans crazy. Diving and embellishment. Rule 64. In the NHL, if you take an obvious dive, it's a 2-minute minor for embellishment. Usually, the guy who hooked you goes to the box for 2 minutes, and you go with him for 2 minutes. 2 minutes of matching shame. What is the mechanism for diving in the UK?
The mechanism in the UK is heavily punitive. It is formally called 2 plus 10.
12 minutes total.
Yes. If you are caught diving or embellishing a foul, you personally receive a 2-minute minor plus an immediate 10-minute misconduct.
So mechanically, how does that work for my team on the ice? Are we shorthanded playing 4-on-5 for 12 agonizing minutes?
No, and this is where the psychology of the rule is brilliant. Your team is only shorthanded for the initial 2 minutes. A substitute player from your bench goes into the penalty box with you. They serve the 2-minute minor portion.
Okay, so sacrificial lamb goes in with you.
Yeah, once those 2 minutes are up, the substitute returns to the ice and your team is back to full strength. But you, the diver, must sit in the penalty box for the full 12 minutes.
So the rule is designed to punish the individual player with a massive loss of ice time without destroying the competitive balance of the entire team for a quarter of the game.
Exactly. Yeah. It isolates the diver in shame, and far more dangerously for you as a player, you are now carrying a misconduct on your record for that game.
Oh, right. The compounding effect.
Yes. As we just discussed, if you make one more mistake that earns a misconduct, like having a loose chin strap or arguing with the ref about the diving call, that is your second misconduct. You are automatically ejected. Diving puts you exactly one mistake away from the trapdoor.
Incredible. Let's cover one more quick trapdoor. The broken stick rule.
This is an absolute zero-tolerance safety rule. If your stick breaks, even if it just cracks and loses structural integrity, you must drop it instantly.
Like it's hot.
Exactly. The new clarification for 2026-27 states that skating with a broken stick anywhere on the ice, not just trying to play the puck, but simply carrying the broken shaft back to the bench to get a new one, is an immediate 2-minute minor for illegal equipment.
Why is it so strict about just carrying it to the bench? It's just a piece of equipment at that point.
Because modern carbon fiber sticks shatter into razor-sharp shards. Carrying a jagged piece of carbon fiber through a crowded ice surface is a massive puncture hazard. If it breaks, you drop it like it is literally on fire, and you skate to the bench empty-handed.
So, weaving this into our mental model of UK penalties, the overarching theme is that the threshold for a game-ending ejection is drastically lower than in North America. You do not need to draw blood or cause an injury to be thrown out. The rules punish the danger of the act, not the result. One reckless act or an accumulation of two minor behavioral misconducts will end your night immediately.
That is exactly how you have to view the game. You are playing on a much thinner margin of error regarding your physical conduct.
Which naturally leads us to the most visceral emotional part of the game. Altercations, fighting, and the concept of the penalty box lockdown. Hockey is an inherently physical, high-adrenaline sport. Tempers flare. Fights happen. If the threshold for ejection is so incredibly low for a simple cross-check, fighting must mean you go to hockey jail forever.
Right.
This is where the UK rulebook does something completely counterintuitive. Amidst all this strictness, we see a very interesting, specific, domestic softening of the rules regarding fighting. Yes. In specific senior leagues, the NIHL, the SNL, and the BUIHA varsity matches, a plain willing fight is punished with a 5-minute major penalty, but it does not carry an automatic game ejection.
Wait, let me get this straight. I can get ejected for a heavy cross check, but I can drop my clubs, have a square willing fist fight with an opponent, and I just sit in the box for 5 minutes and then I'm allowed back into the game.
In those specific senior leagues, yes. The governing bodies recognize that in high-level senior hockey, willing combat is sometimes a pressure release valve.
Wow.
And for the 2026-27 season, they explicitly added a protective rule for the unwilling combatant. If an opponent jumps you and you keep your gloves on and are purely just defending yourself, the referee has the discretion to assess you only a minor or a major penalty, saving you from an ejection while the aggressor is thrown out.
But I see a massive trap here. You carefully emphasize the phrase plain willing fight.
Yeah.
What are the limitations on this 5-minute exception? Because I assume it's not a free-for-all.
The limitations are vast and rigid. This 5-minute exception only applies to two players squaring up fairly, face-to-face, willingly. If you instigate the fight, you are ejected. If you are clearly the aggressor continuing to punch a downed player, you are ejected.
What about sucker punches?
If you throw a sucker punch, you are ejected. If you take the fight off the playing surface, or if you are the third man in joining an already existing fight, you trigger automatic, immediate ejections. The doorway to simply getting a 5-minute major is incredibly narrow.
Let's transition from full fights to those messy scrums. What happens when the whistle blows for a save and everyone starts pushing and shoving in the crease? The rulebook calls this the altercation lockdown, Rule 70. How does the IIHF actually define an altercation? Because in everyday language, an altercation implies punches are being thrown.
In the IIHF rulebook, the definition of an altercation is startlingly broad. It requires just two players and one single penalty.
Just one penalty?
Yes. If the whistle blows, you and an opponent start aggressively pushing each other, and the referee decides to give just one of you a 2-minute minor for roughing, that situation is now legally defined as an altercation. No punches need to be thrown.
Okay, why does that legal definition matter so much?
Because the exact moment an altercation is declared by the referee, the penalty box and the player benches go into a full, strict lockdown.
Let's set the scene to understand the mechanics of this, because this is the penalty box trap. I am sitting in the penalty box. I took a hooking penalty earlier. My 2-minute clock is counting down on the scoreboard. 3, 2, 1, 0. The buzzer sounds. But down in the far corner of the rink, a scrum has started after a whistle, and the referee's arm is up for a roughing penalty.
Okay, an altercation.
Right, so an altercation is occurring. My penalty time is officially up. The off-ice official unlatches the penalty box door. Can I leave the box and skate to my bench?
Think of this exactly like a lockdown drill at a school. Just because the 3:00 p.m. school bell rings for the end of the day, that does not mean you can leave your classroom if the red lockdown alarm is still flashing in the hallway.
That is a perfect analogy.
Yeah.
So if the lockdown alarm is flashing and I step out of the box.
If you step onto the ice or even leave the penalty box area during an active altercation, even if your penalty time has fully expired, and even if you just skate in a wide, peaceful circle around the scrum and don't get involved at all, you receive an automatic minor penalty plus a game misconduct. You are ejected from the game simply for leaving the box during the lockdown.
That is brutal. It requires immense physical restraint. So what is the correct action? What do I do?
You sit on the bench inside the penalty box. You keep the door closed. You do not move until an on-ice official explicitly waves you out or verbally tells the penalty box attendant to release you. Furthermore, there is a second mathematical condition to your release.
Math. In the penalty box.
Yes, regarding extra skater entitlements. You cannot leave the box until your team is legally, mathematically entitled to have an extra skater on the ice.
Explain that.
Let's say you and an opponent are serving coincidental minor penalties. You both went in at the same time. The penalties expire on the clock. But because they were coincidental, your team doesn't get to put a fifth skater on the ice yet. You have to wait for the next stoppage in play anyway. If you jump on the ice the second the clock hits zero, you are creating a too-many-men penalty.
This requires so much situational awareness. What if I think the referee just got it wrong? Say I didn't actually leave the box during the altercation, but the ref from across the ice thought I did. Or say the ref thinks I started a fight, but I was clearly just an unwilling combatant defending myself. In the NHL, they go to the iPad on the bench and review the video. Can we just check the tape in the UK?
No. This is a hard reality of grassroots and domestic hockey. Right. There is absolutely no on-ice video review in EIH or CYHA competitions, and there is no coach's challenge system. The referee's real-time call on the ice is absolutely final for the duration of the game.
So there is no dramatic pointing at the iPad to save myself from an ejection.
None. However, video is heavily used post-game for supplementary discipline. Many rinks stream their games now, so a league disciplinary committee can absolutely review the live stream footage on a Tuesday morning and suspend you for a dangerous hit or a slew foot that the referee entirely missed on Saturday night. But during the 60 minutes of the game, what the referee says goes.
So if I'm building out my mental model of the penalty box, how does a true expert think about their time in the box compared to a beginner?
A beginner thinks their penalty countdown clock solely dictates their release. When it hits zero, they jump on the ice. An expert player knows that the physical state of the ice, whether there are altercations happening, and whether their team is mathematically entitled to an extra skater, dictates their release. The clock hitting zero is only step one of a three-step process.
Okay, we are entering the final major phase of our deep dive. Up to now, we've mostly focused on the rules governing adult players. But hockey is a massive grassroots sport. Let's look at junior hockey and women's hockey. And right away in the source material, there is a massive structural shift in timelines for the youth game.
Yes, the age categories in the UK are structured fundamentally differently from North America, and they just underwent what can only be described as a regulatory earthquake for this new season.
Set the baseline for us first.
UK junior categories run from under 10 all the way up to under 19. They are unisex, and they are based strictly on your calendar birth year, not your school grade or your physical size.
Okay, a strict birth year system makes sense. What was the earthquake?
For the 2026-27 season, the governing bodies moved the age bands by a full calendar year.
What does that actually mean in practice for a family or a coach?
Let's walk through the math. Let's say you have a child born in 2010. Last season, under the older 2025-26 rules, a 2010 birth year placed that player in the under-16 category. They were playing alongside 14 and 15-year-olds. This season, under the new 2026-27 rules, that exact same 2010 birth year skips them entirely over what would have been their next logical step and places them straight into the under-19 category.
Wow.
They are now suddenly playing against 17 and fully grown 18-year-olds.
That is a massive jump. We are talking about skipping grades in a physical combat environment. The difference in physical size, speed, and brain development between a 15-year-old and an 18-year-old is astronomical.
Exactly. And this highlights why our earlier discussion about rule books is so vital. You can never, ever trust a chart from last season or a handy reference graphic you found on an old local club's Facebook page. If a coach relies on old data, they might field an illegal roster, or worse, put a physically underdeveloped child into a dangerous situation against young adults. You must read the active age bands directly out of the current season's in-house rules.
So with these massive shifts in age categories, what does this mean for the penalty structure? We talked extensively about adult men getting ejected for their first major penalty for specific reckless acts. Does that Table 6 ejection rule apply to juniors and women?
It actually applies much more strictly.
Or strictly,
yes. Yeah. In women's hockey, across all age levels, including fully adult women's senior leagues, any major penalty results in an automatic ejection. The rule states no age scope, and the definition of an adult does not exempt a player in the women's leagues from this strictness.
And for the juniors, the U19s down to the U10s.
The natural reading of the rules for junior hockey is exactly the same. Any major penalty ends the game for that youth player. The conservative expert mindset for a youth coach is to plan for an immediate ejection anytime the referee's arm goes up for a 5-minute major. There is zero leniency for endangerment in the youth game.
Which brings us to the ultimate physical question in youth hockey, the great unanswered mystery that parents and coaches argue about endlessly. At what age is full body checking actually legal in the UK?
If we connect this to the bigger picture of how rules are written and layered, this is the ultimate curveball of the UK system. If you take the IIHF rulebook and read it cover to cover, and then you take the UK in-house rules and read them cover to cover, you will not find the answer. Neither document explicitly sets a unified body checking age for men's or junior hockey.
Wait, how is that administratively possible? It's a full contact sport. How can the rulebook not tell you when contact is legal?
The in-house rules have a detailed section instructing officials on how to label a foul like cross-checking, but there is absolutely no rule that explicitly says body checking is introduced and permitted at U14. It simply isn't in the unified text.
But what about relying on North American models? USA Hockey has a very famous, widely studied 12U rule where checking is formally introduced at a specific age with specific clinics. Can a coach just assume the UK follows that global standard?
Absolutely not. As we established in the very first minute of this deep dive, North American baselines do not apply and they do not transfer.
So if it's not in the IIHF book and it's not in the in-house rules, where does the answer physically exist? How does a player know if they're allowed to throw a hit?
The answer exists solely in the specific competition regulations of your local individual league.
The local league.
The league itself, whether it's an English junior league or a Scottish youth league, issues a separate localized document dictating exactly when checking is introduced for their specific tournaments. It is delegated entirely to the grassroots level.
So you literally have to ask your coach or email your league commissioner to confirm the rules of physical engagement before you throw a hit in a new league.
You must ask before the season begins. If you assume checking is legal because you are a certain age and you level a kid in a non-checking league, you are going to be ejected and heavily suspended for endangerment. Do not assume.
So, wrapping up this final section on age and juniors, the mental model is clear. Never assume that age bans or checking rules transfer smoothly from North America, and never even assume they stay the same from last season to this season. You have to verify your specific age bracket and the local checking rules with the current local league documentation.
Verification is the only way to protect yourself and your players.
This has been absolutely mind-blowing. We have covered an immense amount of ground. We need to tie this all together for the listener. It's time for our final mastery review. Let's synthesize everything we've discussed into that coherent, bulletproof mental framework we promised at the start.
The most effective way to mentally organize and retain all of this information is to visualize the UK hockey rulebook as a layered filter system.
A filter system, okay.
You never just look at one source of truth. You start at the top with the strict IIHF international baseline that defines the game. Then you filter that through the UK in-house overrides, which make things like neck guards incredibly strict and fundamentally alter face-off mechanics.
Right.
Finally, you filter all of that through your local league rules to get the final layer of specifics, like what age you can body check, whether you play overtime, and the physical, sometimes smaller, geometry of the specific rink you are standing in.
If the listener is driving their car right now or walking to the rink, and they need to lock in the absolute highest value concepts from this entire masterclass,
mm-hmm.
What are the top five strategic takeaways?
If you remember only five things, remember these. Number one, neck guards are strictly mandatory for everyone, regardless of your age or experience. And missing one is an instant, unwarned, 10-minute penalty.
Zero tolerance.
Number two, your rink is very likely physically smaller than the international standard, and rules like the trapezoid might be suspended, so you must consciously adjust your perception of time, space, and angles.
Play the rink, not the rule book.
Number three, a first major penalty for a reckless act will very likely result in an automatic ejection. You do not need to cause a physical injury to be thrown out. The recklessness of the act itself is enough.
The action, not the result.
Number four, an altercation is defined by just two players and one penalty, and it immediately locks down the penalty box. Do not step onto the ice until a referee explicitly tells you to, regardless of what the clock says.
The school lockdown drill.
Exactly. And number five, never assume that North American rules, age bans, or the specific checking cultures of the NHL apply to you in the UK.
So if I'm trying to think exactly like an expert as I step into a UK rink tonight.
An expert doesn't just memorize the rules. An expert understands the administrative reality. They know exactly which year's rulebook their officials are holding.
Right.
An expert adapts their physical playstyle to the geometry of the rink they're actually standing on. And most importantly, an expert never ever leaves their fate to a referee's warning that doesn't legally exist in the rulebook. You anticipate the strictest possible interpretation of the rules, and you play within them to protect yourself and your team.
I absolutely love that framing. Protect yourself by knowing the administrative rules better than anyone else on the ice. Well, thank you so much for joining us on this incredibly detailed deep dive. It truly feels like we've dismantled a lot of dangerous assumptions today and replaced them with something highly practical. But before we sign off, I want to leave you, the listener, with a final broader concept to mull over.
What is the final thought?
Think back to the very beginning of our conversation. We talked about how x-rays give you a clear binary answer, but stepping onto the ice in the UK is a layered regulatory reality.
Yeah.
If the UK is enforcing rules like zero tolerance, mandatory neck guards for adults, 12-minute isolating penalties for diving, and instant ejections for reckless stick work that doesn't even draw blood, how is this regulatory environment going to shape the actual culture and the fundamental playing style of British hockey over the next decade?
That's a great question.
When you compare this environment to the NHL, is this incredibly strict enforcement going to successfully engineer a faster, highly skilled, cleaner game focused purely on speed? Or is it simply going to create a game that is constantly interrupted by whistles, heavily penalized, and frustrating for physical players to navigate?
That is the ultimate looming question for the sport here. Do hyper-strict rules breed a better style of hockey or just a more heavily litigated one?
It is something fascinating for you to think about as you watch the game evolve. Take this layered mental model to your next practice. Share these trapdoors with your teammates before someone takes a 10-minute misconduct in warm-ups for a missing piece of Velcro. And as always, stay insanely curious. We'll see you on the next deep dive.